How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvarez and Dave Meltzer here, Wrestling Observer Radio. It is October 18, 2013, here at figure4online.com/wrestlingobserver.com. Bob Holly is on the line today. Second time on the show in the last couple of months. We had a lot of stuff to talk about here today. And Bob, how you doing?
I'm doing good. Thank you guys for having me. First, I want to apologize for not being on the show next week. I had some stuff come up and I had to take care of. So last week I had I had to have an MRI done, and a spot came open to where I can get in earlier and get an MRI done on my back, so I had that done. So, but I want to apologize to everybody who thought I was going to be on last week, and I wasn't. So,
real, other than that,
how are you guys doing?
We're doing good. Real quick, physically, you know, I mean, how do you feel right now?
Well, I feel great. I feel really good. I work out. I'm in the gym 5 days a week, and I work out just as hard as I did when I was wrestling.
Now, the MRI, I mean, what came up, and do you have results back yet?
Yeah, I got the results back. Just typical stuff, a degenerative disc and stuff like that, and just narrowing of the, you know, your spinal cord and, you know, nerves being pinched and all that good stuff. And it's just part of the game that I played for all the years, and it just goes with the territory. So, but other than that, I was just, you know, because I was having a lot of pain in my lower back, and I wanted to know what was causing it, and now that I know, and I know what to do to correct it. So that's always a good thing.
I mean, when you're training and stuff, I mean, are there things that you have to avoid in training that you'd like to do, or you pretty much can do whatever you want, but just be careful?
I still do pretty much everything I've always done. I just have to kind of modify the movement just a little bit. I mean, not too much. And I just, you know, I do have to be careful to an extent. And a lot of times I really don't think about it, and I just push through it because I want to remain in great shape, and I want to look like as if I just, you know, if I was still wrestling and stuff. And that's the thing. I've always been one of these guys where when I'm finished wrestling, if somebody sees me in 2 or 3, 4, 5 years down the road, I don't want somebody to go, my God, what happened to him? He used to be in such great shape, and now look at him. You know, and I don't want to be one of those guys because it disappoints me. I feel sad for the guys when they used to look like a gladiator, and then you see them, and they're just a shell of themselves, and it's because they stopped working out or stopped taking care of themselves because they don't care. And I've never, you know, and I didn't want people to, you know, look at me like that because I don't want people to feel sorry for me, number one. And I've always told myself, no matter what, I'm always still going to work. If I can walk, I'm going to work out. So, you know, and I've just always, you know, I've always been an advocate of, you know, taking good care of myself.
Now, how about diet? Is it easier now that you're out of wrestling, or now that you don't have the... you're not on TV every week. You can let it go a little bit here and there.
No, diet still, actually, it's pretty easy. It's actually harder on the road because you don't have the choices like you do as if you were at home, you know, me and my wife going to the grocery store, getting the proper things. But on the road, I mean, you could still diet on the road. Your choices are just really limited as far as what you can eat and stuff like that. I mean, I didn't eat squeaky clean when I was on the road, because you didn't really have to, because you were doing so much, you know, between working out and wrestling every single night. And plus you were constantly on the go. So you're constantly burning calories constantly. So you didn't have to eat squeaky clean. And like to this day, I don't eat squeaky clean because I, you know, train so hard and I do so much. So I can get away with having, you know, the fun food here and there.
Now, as far as, like, how much wrestling you're doing right now, I mean, you had mentioned you're doing a couple of overseas things. I mean, how much do you want to do, or do you not really want to do much? I mean, what's kind of, like, your goal as far as, like, whatever limited involvement in the wrestling business you want to have right now?
Yeah, I just don't want to get in that cycle of where I'm traveling every week after week. I don't mind doing wrestling seminars. I mean, I would do those quite a bit if I could, because I really love teaching people. I really love that. And don't get me wrong, I love wrestling. I just the traveling part, I just don't want to get caught up into that mix of being away from my family so much again, because I can get booked every weekend if I wanted to, but I choose not to. And plus, I'm kind of cautious of, you know, promoters out there and stuff, because I've heard a lot of horror stories from my friends that they promoters would end up not paying them or not paying them what they agreed to and things of that sort. And so, you know, I just don't want to get caught up into all that, because I'm really happy at home doing my own thing. So, because I really enjoy being with my family. And but if somebody calls that I know, you know, that I'm personal with, and I know they have a good history of putting on good shows and things like that, you know, I'll do shows for them. So, and I just don't, like I said, I just don't want to get caught up doing shows every weekend. And the way I do it now, I really enjoy it, because it's not the same thing over and over. And it just kind of, the way I'm doing it, it makes me look forward to going and doing a show maybe, because I haven't done one in a while. So the way I do it now, I really enjoy how I have it set up now.
When you, I think a lot of people, I mean, one of the things when I read your book, you know, I, for whatever reason, I'd always assumed, you know, you were from Mobile, Alabama, you know, and you grew up in Alabama watching, you know, Alabama wrestling and things like that, and didn't realize that, you know, life took you there. It wasn't even necessarily by choice. It was just, you know, it happened, and you actually grew up in California and then in Oregon. And, you know, I'd done some emails with you, and you'd mentioned, you know, growing up and watching like Dutch Savage and Buddy Rose and Portland wrestling and things like that. And I don't think a lot of people realize that that's like, as your childhood background watching wrestling, that was the wrestling you grew up on.
Yeah. That to me, that was the best wrestling. If people could go back and see that kind of wrestling, you know, it's funny, because when I was a kid, the very first time it was a Saturday morning, and we were living in Ventura, California. And I honestly can't remember what age I was, but all I remember is being able to turn the TV on Saturday morning, and there was roller derby, and it was the Los Angeles T-Birds. And I got hooked on that because of the physicality of it, and I just thought that was the greatest thing in the world. I want to be a roller derby guy, and that was what I was going to do. And that's all I thought about. And then when my family uprooted and moved to Oregon, then I seen professional wrestling, and, you know, I saw Portland wrestling and big time wrestling out of California, out of Sacramento, California. And then that is what I thought, you know, this is even better than roller derby. And come to find out, you know, they're both under the same banner. They're entertainment, you know, in a sort, but it was kind of a violent entertainment to me. And I really enjoyed that. And, but yeah, that's what got me hooked on it was, you know, Portland Wrestling, Dutch Savage, Playboy Buddy Rose, Jimmy Superfly Snuka, Roddy Piper, those guys like that, you know, the Sheep Herders. And I was just, I had me hooked from day one, from the very first time I turned it on, when we moved to Oregon.
So you watch the thing every Saturday night then?
Yes, every Saturday night. On Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock, I watched Big Time Wrestling out of Sacramento, California. It was on from 3 to 4. And then at 8:30 on Saturday nights, from 8:30 to 10, was Portland Wrestling. And even when I was in high school, all my buddies were going out on Saturday night. I stayed home and I watched Portland Wrestling. I would not go nowhere on a Saturday night. I mean, Wow. That's how much passion I had for it. And that's how bad I mean, I was hooked on it, and I didn't want to miss a Saturday night because it was so good.
Yeah, and we didn't have, I mean, the funniest thing is when I was basically your age, we started getting cable, and so we had at 3 o'clock to 5 o'clock here was Georgia Championship Wrestling.
Yep.
And I was like really into going to the beach and pool and swimming all summer, and it used to be like one of those things where, you know, at 2:55, it's like I had to rush out of there because I didn't want to miss even a second of Georgia Championship Wrestling at 3:05. I mean, it was just like, yeah. You know, that is like what, eventually I got smart and bought a VCR for like $800 is what they went for in those days.
Because
I was just feeling so bad that I was like, having to leave all my friends at 2:55 every Saturday afternoon, you know what I mean?
Yeah, oh yeah, I know exactly what you mean. My friends used to, you know, they couldn't figure out why I liked wrestling so much because, you know, they for whatever reason, they didn't get into it like I did. You know, and they thought, you know, going out and partying and having a good time was, you know, better than Saturday night home watching wrestling. But, and see, I was just the opposite because I didn't care about drinking or going out and partying. You know, I wanted to watch wrestling. And like you, you know, I watched at 3:05 also. Once that started coming on, you know, when I got cable also, it was on TBS, I believe.
Right, it was TBS on Channel 17, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, and then that in-studio wrestling that they did, I thought that was the greatest thing ever. You know, it was good. That was good TV. I mean, they knew what the way they wrote those shows, you know, back then, of course, they didn't know they had writers and all that stuff and people that, you know, that wrote out shows and storylines, stuff like that. But that was the best stuff. And it's like, too bad we can't get back to that. But that'll never come back. It's just too far gone as far as that. It's just evolved so much that it'll never get back to its roots like that.
I mean, the funny part of it is that they spend so much time scripting out interviews. And the interviews that I remember on all of those shows, whether it was Portland Wrestling, San Francisco Wrestling, and Georgia Wrestling, I mean,
yeah.
Those interviews, I mean, I remember, you know, I would almost look forward more to the interviews than the matches. I was like, almost, sometimes if there was a long match, get this match over with so I can hear, you know, the stars do the interviews for Friday night show or whatever city they were promoting.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I used to, like, Pat Patterson in Big Time Wrestling, watching him do the, you know, because he's a big babyface back then. And I remember him and Mr. Saito, they were going to have some kind of martial arts match or something where they both were wearing a gi, and you know, and the promos that they cut were just so believable. And then he did another one with Bob Roop, and they involved a ladder, you know, incorporated a ladder. It wasn't quite a ladder match back then, but they just incorporated a ladder somehow. And then, you know, he cracked Pat Patterson with the ladder and then split his head wide open, and that was the best stuff. Just like in Portland Wrestling, they would be up in the crow's nest. Buddy Rose would be cutting these great promos, and they would get up there, and you know, guys would be in the ring wrestling, and Buddy Rose would be up in the crow's nest cutting a promo, you know, and guys like Roddy Piper would come running from the ring up into the crow's nest, and they'd get into it, and it was just, that was good TV.
What did you think as a high school kid watching wrestling, loving it? And nowadays, if you're a kid in high school and you love wrestling, it's pretty easy. You go on the internet and, oh, there's 8,000 different schools I can go train at. It was not like that when you were in high school. What were you thinking about what it would take to get into pro wrestling? I mean, did you have any sort of idea about what would you need to do, where you need to go? Or was it just sort of like, I just got to watch this and enjoy it until something comes up?
Yeah, I was like you said, I was, how do I get into this? What do I need to do? And I'll never forget, Portland Wrestling had a show in Grants Pass, Oregon, because I lived in Grants Pass. You know, I went to high school there. And for the first time, they were coming to Grants Pass, you know, because usually they went to Medford, which was like 30, 45 minutes away. And, of course, I didn't have the means of transportation getting there, so I could never make it. And I was working a job in a meat company, and I was kind of the guy that cleaned up the place after they were done carving up the animals and stuff like that. I had to clean the kill truck and all that stuff. But long story short, I asked my boss if I could have that night off to go see the show, and he said no. And I mean, I was pissed because this was my first opportunity to go see wrestling live, you know, see Buddy Rose, Roddy Piper, Dutch Savage, my heroes, you know? And so I went to work, and the show started at 8 o'clock, and I worked from 3 till 11 or 12 at night, and I ended up cutting the night short. I got in a lot of trouble for it, but they never fired me. I ended up making the show, getting to see the show, and getting to, you know, the story. The point I'm trying to get to is this is how I thought I was going to get into wrestling. I thought I was going to be able to talk to Buddy Rose. And so, after the show was over, I went out in the parking lot, and I saw Buddy crossing the parking lot, and I could tell he was in a hurry So I kind of just casually walked up to him and said, "Hey, buddy, how are you?" And I just as I started asking, I mean, he was gone just that fast. And so I was just like, "Wow, this is how am I going to get into wrestling?" You know, because there was no way back then. You know, you had no avenue to get into it unless you actually knew somebody. You know, so, and it just kind of, you know, disappointed me a little bit because I didn't actually get to talk to him like I wanted to and then, you know, ask a simple question. But, you know, it's tough back then to get into it.
Now, what were your thoughts when you went to that live event? Because you'd been watching wrestling on television for a long time and you're finally there and you're getting to see this live. And I remember when I was a kid, you know, my friends, we all watch on television. Then you go to that first live event and it looks weird. Like all of a sudden it looks more like a stage play than anything else. Because
it didn't when I was a kid.
It did when I was a kid, but I went to WWF events, so that's a little bit different.
I mean, I remember when I went, it looked like a freaking fight.
Well, I was going to different shows. Portland Wrestling probably looked more like a fight as well, but what were your thoughts watching that first live event?
Oh my God, I was sitting there before the show started, and I went by myself, and it was just like so real because when I was outside, I could kind of see in the gymnasium, it was kind of in the gymnasium, and I saw the ring post, this is just like it was yesterday, and when I saw that ring post, I was like, oh my God, it was so surreal to me, and because I saw that corner post, and that's all I saw, and I was like, oh my God, I am actually here at a wrestling event. I am fixing to see these guys that I watch on TV. And I was just on cloud nine. And so when I walked in and I sat down, I was looking, it was almost like I was in total shock and disbelief when I was sitting there. Because I saw the ring in the middle of the gymnasium floor, and I was looking around at all the people coming in and everything. And then once that first match came out, and it was Brett Sawyer, and I can't remember who he was wrestling. It was a local guy or whatever. But I remember that, and I was just, it was like my mouth was just hanging open. Like I still could not believe I was here. And then, you know, of course, I saw it was a cage match that night between Buddy Rose and Dutch Savage. And after the night was over, I just sat there because I didn't want the show to be over. And it was funny because Dutch Savage had walked by after the whole show was over because I didn't want to leave. I just wanted to, you know, take everything in and just make that moment last as long as it could. Because I didn't have no idea when I was going to get the opportunity to see this again. And so Dutch Savage came out of the locker room and he had walked by and because there were still a lot of people hanging around. And he looked up at me because the way the gymnasium is, it has a gymnasium floor and then the bleachers kind of go up. You know, it was built in a stadium. It's a stadium-like gymnasium with the bleachers. And you know, so I was kind of sitting up, and he looked up, and he goes, "I guess these people just don't know to leave, do they?" And I was just like, "Whoa, wait a minute! He just spoke to me." You know, I was in shock over that, and you know, and so it was just I didn't want that moment to end, that night to end, and you know, it was an incredible, incredible night for me.
How did that affect you as a wrestler later on in your career? I mean, did you sort of carry that with you where whenever you were at a show, it was like, you know, there may be kids here that this is their first show and they're feeling the same way I felt when I went to this event.
Yeah. You know what? That always come back to me. And I always wondered that if they had the same feeling with me, you know, that I had with, you know, Dutch Savage and Buddy Rose back then, if they looked at me like the way I looked at them, you know, and I've always wondered that. And I, you know, always hoped that. And, you know, it's funny because I did a book signing here not too long ago at a college here. And one of the guys had walked up to me and he said, "I just wanted to let you know that I got into wrestling because of you. He said, the very first time I ever turned on wrestling, he said, I turned the TV on and you were in the ring. And from that moment, I was just, he said, I was hooked on watching you because I, you know, he thought I was a really good athlete. And he said, from that moment, you inspired me to become a wrestler. And he wrestles in college right now because, you know, of that moment he saw me on TV. So, you know, in a sense that came, you know, it came back to me that, you know, maybe he did look up to me like, you know, I did with those other guys. So, you know, but it's funny because I've always often wondered that same exact thing that, you know, if they did look up to me, if kids did look up to me like I looked up to, you know, my heroes.
You know, coming on to, like, what's been happening in WWE in the last year or so, last couple of months, I know you had kind of mentioned before we went on, you know, talking about some of the things that have happened in the last couple of months with some of the talent. I mean, what's kind of like your thoughts, you know, and how often do you watch the product, and what's kind of your thoughts on the product right now?
You know, I don't watch much of it. I try to catch some of it here and there, and it's really hard for me to comment on the product because I don't sit and watch the whole thing. You know, I do like the storyline of Daniel Bryan. I like all that, what's going on. I thought that was kind of, you know, neat. And, you know, it drew a little bit of interest with me. But as far as, you know, watching WWE, I really don't. TNA, I was watching some of TNA, and here lately it's just really hard for me to watch. And, you know, I hate to say that, but it's just how I feel. You know, it's really tough for me to watch. And it's just like the whole thing when they brought in Tito Ortiz and Rampage Jackson. You know, I knew that was just a ploy to push their pay-per-view, and they brought them in hoping they were going to pop the ratings on that show, and obviously they didn't. And, you know, so I figured that was a total waste of money there when they could be investing in people that are actually, you know, professional wrestlers instead of MMA fighters. But you know, like I saw Eva Marie for the first time, I guess, last week or whatever.
Lucky you.
I am so sorry. The woman looks great, but the marquee is wrestling. That woman has no business being on TV right now. None whatsoever. I was actually embarrassed watching it. You know, I was embarrassed for her. You know, as long as she's been down there at NXT, that girl should know how to sell by now. She ought to know what to do by now, and it's obvious she doesn't. I don't know if it was nerves or anything, but maybe I'll give her the benefit of the doubt. You know, she was rushing everything, but whoever's training her, they need to do a little bit better job before they turn her loose on TV, and I'm sure most of America will agree with me on that.
Well, I mean, the thing there is that she was on that reality show, and they just felt compelled because she came off well on the reality show to make her a wrestler. But I mean, one of the things that I, you know, when I watch, it's like, you know, everyone's got things they're good at and everyone's got things that they're not so good at. And
right.
If her personality is good, then figure out a way to do her personality. But I mean, I had heard, you know, and a lot about, like, her and the other girl that were on NXT and how their training was going and things like that. And essentially that neither was anywhere close to being ready. But I think that they just felt, we'll do that. But I mean, why they felt compelled to put her in the ring, because it benefited, you know, it benefited no one. It doesn't make her more of a star because she's on TV in a wrestling match looking like she's got no business there.
Well, it's not just that, but you put her with the worst possible opponents on a live show.
On a live show, that's right. Well, yeah, it's not even, she didn't even have veterans carrier. That's right.
Right, right, right. And the thing is, to me, the Bella Twins, you know, they've got a lot to learn still. You know, they can't lead a match, you know, so, and Oksana, I honestly, you know, I don't know this girl, but for that moment, I felt sorry for Oksana because here she does that crawl where she kind of does that cat crawl around as her opponent's down, she kind of tries to do that little cat crawl to get heat, And Eva Marie didn't even give her time to let her do her little thing. You know, she was trying to come up, and I felt bad for Oksana there. You know, those girls, a lot of them girls, they need a lot more, you know, a lot more training. They really, really do. And, you know, like the talent down at TNA, the women down at TNA, you know, they got a lot of great talent down there. Those, to me, those girls, they have something, you know, and I'd like to see WWE get to the point where they've got girls as good as the girls down in TNA, you know. If you know, do you guys agree with me? Yes, no.
I mean, the thing with TNA is they've kind of like, you know, they kind of like, what's the word I'm looking for? I mean, the division, when you had like Mickie James and Tara, and you know, it had a lot more. And now that those two are gone, you know, to me, it's kind of like you got Gail Kim, ODB, and then you know, and also Taryn Terrell, who was actually improving greatly and really had obviously. Was really coming on, and then she's gone too. So it's like,
right?
They lost what they had. They did have a really, you know, good division, you know, not all that long ago.
Yeah, that Taryn Terrell, the match that she had, you know, with
Gail
said her name, Gail Kim.
Taryn Terrell,
they had that ladder
really
match. That was off the hook for those guys.
Yeah,
I don't know if you guys saw that match.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
I saw it. I thought it was a really good laid out match. And they did a great job, you know, and they were very snug with each other, you know, and it looked really tight. Everything looked nice and tight. I mean, there was a few mistakes here and there, but still, overall, you're not going to find a better women's match than that, in my opinion. You know, Gail Kim, to me, you know, and I've said this before, and I'll say it again, you know, I don't know Gail Kim that well. But to me, she is one of the best female workers right now to this day in the business. That's just solely my opinion. And like I said, you know, I have no connection with her, no ties whatsoever. Just from what I see her on TV, how hard she works, she does a great, great job. And the girls in WWE, I'd like to see them get to that level too, because I think that would help make the product, because I really think the fans in WWE really don't care too much about the girls right now.
No, I think that they're, you know, for the most part, I mean, I think there's some interest in AJ Lee, but for the most part, it's just that, it's just like 5-minute filler on television.
Right, right. And I think, you know, it, and like Eva Marie, I just think it exposes them when they're in the ring doing, you know, like she did the other night. And I think that has a lot to do with the way the fans react to them. You know, I'm just guessing, you know, so, but I just think, like you said, they could find something for her to do other than get in that ring right now and utilize her in a different manner instead of just throwing her out there to the wolves. And because the fans know, you know, the fans are not stupid and they know she wasn't ready. You know, I don't know why they did that, but, you know, and the thing is, too, maybe just give her just a quick spot to do something, or, you know, something real quick to do so they don't expose her. Because there's ways to do that instead of trying to make her sell, make her do certain moves and things like that, you know. But like you said, they could have went a different way with her and utilized her in a different manner, I think.
Now, I know you wanted to talk about a couple of current and now former guys. We'll start with the release of Ted. Actually, I guess
he left on his own.
Yeah, he was looking to get out. But Ted DiBiase Jr.
Yeah, and I know why he was looking to get out on his own, and it's because they weren't using him properly.
Yeah,
you know, and you cannot. Okay, this is what bothers me. Okay, they always stress, especially JR. You know, when he writes his blogs and stuff like that, he's always saying, this is what we look for in a guy that to make it to the top. You know, he's got to have all the tools. He's got to be a hell of an athlete. He's got to be able to talk. He's got to have charisma, you know, the whole nine yards to make it. And they've got to want it. And you can't tell me this kid ain't got it. Come on. And you can't sit there and tell me, Ted DiBiase, they cannot find something for him to do. And because when I was there, when I worked with him, and the first time I ever seen him work, I thought, this guy kind of reminds me of Randy Orton. but in his own way, in his own manner. He's got his own style. He's got his own way of doing things. But he reminded me of how good Randy was when Randy was there at, you know, from the beginning. You know, I saw something in Randy when he was there, you know, his first few matches. Of course, I worked with him for a while. But like Ted DiBiase Jr., I saw something in him, and even when I worked with the guy, I was like, this guy's got what it takes to make it to the top. And I really believe he will, because his promos were good. His work was good. He had charisma. He had every tool it took. And I was hell-bent. I knew this guy was going to be a top guy one day. I just knew it. Before I left, I was like, this guy's going to make it. And I've always liked him. Very nice guy. I have a ton of respect for the guy, and I was rooting for the guy. And when I found out, you know, and then they start, you know, he was doing good on TV, and then next thing I know, I tune in the TV, and he's doing a job. And then, you know, here later on, I'll watch TV or I'll read something where the matches for the house show for that night, and you know, that Ted got beat. And then I got thinking, why is Ted getting beat all the time? And then I was like, well, maybe he did something wrong. Maybe they're punishing for whatever reason. Or maybe he got too big for his britches. I don't know. And I was just trying to think of reasons why they're making him do jobs all the time. And then next thing I know, I read where Ted's hanging it up. And I can understand why. And then I see the reason for letting Ted go is because they don't have anything for the guy. And I was like, okay, that's a bunch of BS. Okay, because let me tell you something. I was there. I know how the game is played. And you can't, because you have guys that are out for a while due to injuries or whatever, and they come back, and it's funny how they always find a role for that guy to come back in. And you mean to tell me WWE cannot find anything for this guy? Something is wrong there. Somebody doesn't like him for whatever reason, or somebody just doesn't want him on top for whatever reason. I don't know. But you cannot sit there, WWE cannot sit there and insult the fans' intelligence by saying, well, we just can't throw him out there in anything. Well, you know what? Sheamus is coming back. I don't know if he's back yet or not, but he's been off for a while. I guarantee they're going to throw him right out there and find something for him because he's Hunter's friend. You know, Rey Mysterio, he gets hurt. I don't know how many times a year and how many times he comes back, they always find something for Ray. So you cannot sit there and tell me and all these fans out there that are Ted DiBiase fans or whoever fans they are that they cannot find something for this man, because I know they can if they really wanted to. And it upsets me that they're doing this to a guy, because Jim Ross is always saying what it takes to make it in WWE. And I'm sitting there, Ted's got all the tools. I just don't understand it.
I mean, one of the things, I think a couple things happened with him. Number one is they gave him his father's gimmick, which was absolute death for him. And then they put him with Maurice, and they had no chemistry. So that was a bad deal. And then he had some injuries. One of the things I've noticed is certain guys, and you mentioned this like with Sheamus or John Cena, you know, obviously when you're at the top and you get hurt and you come back, you're going to be plugged back in at the top. But a lot of guys, and we saw this even this year with Fandango and with Dolph Ziggler, it's like, and they were guys who were, you know, being used well. They get a concussion. They're out for several weeks. And then when they come back, it's almost like, you know, it's like they're so concerned with concussions, and rightly so, because of, you know, what's happened with the NFL and everything like that. And then just for the good of the guys in the business and everything like that, you learn more and all that, you know. But at the same time, I almost see that, like, They want you to report it. They won't let you go back until you're ready to go back. But it just seems to me that a lot of guys, when they have concussions and they take time off, boy, when they come back, they're in a different spot, and it's not a better one. And I always thought that's like a bad...
I have a theory, though, at least in the case of Dolph Ziggler. I don't know this, but I have seen Dolph Ziggler do some matches, and he's taken some crazy bumps. You can't tell me that there's not somebody in the back that's saying, dude, relax a little bit out there. Don't bump so hard. You're going to get hurt. And I can see a situation where if a guy like Dolph has been told, you got to kind of tone it down a little, you're going to get hurt. I know you get excited, but you got to tone it down a little. And then he goes out there and gets hurt. I can see him coming back and them going, well, you know, we told this guy, he didn't listen, he got hurt, so we need to back off on this guy a little bit.
Right, and I agree. You know, because let me tell you something. It's like, I can understand where they're coming from, you know, at that aspect of the game. But the thing is, when you're a guy like Dolph, you have such a passion for what you do because you want to go out there and entertain everybody. It's really hard to pull back because you always think, you know, I'm good to go. I'm not going to get hurt again. And you never know when you're going to get hurt. That's the thing. You never know. But it's really hard to pull back because I really, in my mind, I always thought if I don't go all out every single night, they're going to think that I don't care anymore. You know, so it's kind of a double-edged sword because if Dolph goes out there and he pulls back, I promise you there's going to be somebody back there saying, wonder what's wrong with him.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
No.
So it's kind of a double-edged sword. And it's like, does the guy not care anymore? But then, you know, again, like you said, he goes out there and gives, because he does some crazy stuff. And he reminds me of Gumby. I mean, he's so flexible. But I think it's just the passion that he has and the desire, and he loves it so much. He loves what he does. And I just think that he just wants to go out there and give 100% every single night, no matter what. Because honestly, and it is true, they will. If you, and even if somebody tells him to pull back, they might think, well, you know, he's just something's wrong here. He's not the same guy that we used to see every week. You know, why is he doing that? Like I said, it's kind of a double-edged sword.
Yeah. Now here's one thing. When you have a guy who's, you know, like, you know, obviously size is a big deal there. It always has been and always will be, even though, you know, if you're, you know, in the right, if the right opportunities come, you know, I mean, guys that are small have gotten shots, you know, when cards fall their way and everything. But I mean, like, a guy like Dolph, just as an example, who's smaller than average, but a good, you know, a good athlete who was, you know, good at sports growing up all the way through. Do you think that there's almost this thing of, if I don't outshine everyone because of my size, I'm just going to be another guy. And probably a guy who, you know, again, he's a guy, I know people who went to high school with him. I'm, you know, somewhat friends with a guy who went to high school with him. And this was a guy who, you know, I don't know what age, but I know when he was in high school, all he talked about was pro wrestling. And he ended up being a great amateur wrestler because all he cared about was pro wrestling and he wanted to do that. And so you're talking about a guy who, you know, from whatever age, you know, was wanting to do this thing and wanting to excel and had that mentality of wanting to excel because he came from, you know, a sport of amateur wrestling, which is, you know, very difficult sport to excel at. And he did,
right.
You know, you know, again, I don't think he wants to be just another guy on the card. So I think he feels compelled that if I'm just another guy on the card at smaller than usual size, you know, I can fall off the radar real easy.
Yeah. You know what? I that could be it, but also it's almost like a competition because you always, no matter what, I don't care who you are, and when you're in the back, what's going through your head is I want to steal the spotlight. I want to go out there and give the best performance of the night of anybody. And it's a competition. It's a competition amongst the boys. Who can do better? And I guarantee he has that mentality of, if I pull back, I'm not going to be perceived that I'm as good as I used to be. And if I pull back, I'm not going to be able to give the performance that I normally give. And it's just going to be a subpar performance and people aren't even going to think about it. Because let me tell you something. When he goes out there every night, you know, he's been out there. Because of the performance he gives. And I think that's why he does that, because he makes it very memorable. Because when I think back, when I do watch a show and he is on the show, I'm always thinking, all right, what's the best that I saw tonight? And he's always one that stands out to me, you know, because he just goes out there and you can tell he gives 100%. And so, and I just really think because of his size, and honestly, I don't even know if he thinks about his size. I really, really don't. he just, it's just a natural instinct for him to go out there and be the best on that card that night. And actually that's it. And it's true, because that's what everybody actually tries to do. If you don't care about what you do, then you're not going to go out there and try to be the best on the show that night, because the mentality that they should have is, I'm going out there tonight and I'm going to go out there and I'm going to make sure that everybody knows I was in on this show tonight. And they should. But it's like I said, it's still just a double-edged sword. You're damned if you do, damned if you don't. Because I'm going to tell you too, and I've said it before, if you go out there and you have a bad night and you're not up to snuff on how you normally are, it's almost like they start rethinking your career. So you want to go out there and give 100% and go wide open, because you don't want them, the writers, to rethink, okay, we might need to go another direction because he's not what we thought he was going to be. Even if you've had 100 straight nights, which you don't, but I'm just kind of exaggerating. Let's just say you have a two-week tour, and you have, 10 nights where you've had the best match, one of the best matches of the whole tour, and then just one night you're off for whatever reason, because you're tired, you've been on the road, or whatever. And it's funny, because in the agent reports, they start, he didn't have a very good match. And I promise you, they put more thought into you not having a good match than if you had a good match. And because that, they do think about that. And it's really bizarre how that works, because they know how good somebody is, like Dolph. And if he was to be off for whatever reason, it's almost like they rethink your whole career. And it shouldn't be like that. But it really is sometimes in a lot of cases.
Now, you had a long run there. Did you notice any kind of a shift as far as, because there was a period, certainly, like, I mean, going through, like, watching WWE live events, I mean, there's different stages. I mean, like in the 80s, they had those guys on, like, what were absolutely insane schedules, like that nobody could perform at a top level night after night when you're working 30 straight nights. I mean, literally 30 straight nights and
right,
crisscrossing the country with no logic on the schedule. I mean, I remember watching these guys and looking in their eyes, and it's like, and these were, and the guys were talented as hell, but it was they couldn't possibly do the kind of matches that you were used to, or that I could see at a territorial day or something like that. And then you had a period where, I don't know, there were certain guys who worked hard and certain guys who didn't, and then it kind of changed again. To where I think that, and I don't know exactly when the turning point was, but I know that, where you really did get, like, mostly good matches, with an exception of a few guys that weren't really up to snuff. But I mean, right. Did you notice a difference, say, from like the 90s to 2000 or something like that? Like when Benoit and Eddie Guerrero and these guys and Kurt Angle started coming in, where you really had some, the talent level really was, Edge and Christian and these guys, they all started, the talent level really started to rise at one point.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's funny, because when I came in, they were at the tail end of those long, those 30, 45, it's funny, because I talked to Bret Hart one time, and he told me his longest stint, if I'm not mistaken, was like 90 days, I think, because I think what he was trying to, get enough money to build a house. If I'm not mistaken, that's what he's talking about, building a house so he could pay it off and not have a house payment. And because he wanted to stay on the road. So I think his longest stint, he told me it was like 90 days, and that's an insane schedule. And when I came in, those guys were starting to slow down a little bit. When I came in, we were doing like 3 weeks, and then home for a couple days, and then back out for another 2 weeks. And it would almost alternate, 3 weeks here, 2 weeks here. My longest stint was 30 days. And
that's still enough to go crazy, I think, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, it was. It was, but I didn't know any difference, so, and I thought, just this is the way it's going to be. Okay, just go with it. And, and I didn't have a problem with it. Yeah, I hated being on the road so much, but I thought, okay, this is what it takes to be with this company, and you do what you got to do. And then, you know, like you said, as other guys started coming in, everything started changing. And then we'd start going, you know, 2 weeks, and then we'd have 3 or 4 days off. And then it changed, and then all of a sudden it changed after, I think, the Attitude Era. It changed back in the, I think, mid-2000, a little bit, maybe 3-04. Then we started doing the 4 days on, 3 days off, except when we went overseas, and then we'd be gone for like 2 weeks or something like that. And it's funny because you'd see these guys, you know, that aren't used to traveling, that 2 weeks and they're wiped out. They just have no gas left in their tank. And it was just kind of funny to sit back and watch these guys, you know, because here me and others are used to going and going and going, and you have these new guys coming in, and it's like they're wiped out and they can't figure out, geez, we got to keep going, you know. And it was kind of comical to see how wore out they were. And but yeah, I think the schedule now, a lot of them would drop if they had to go 3 weeks without a day off, you know, and double shots on the weekends. You know, the schedule changed a lot, you know. And I don't know, I'm sure they still do now the 4 days, 3 day deal. I'm pretty sure.
It's pretty much the one cruise Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, another cruise Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, in theory. I mean, there's always changes in, like, yeah, a guy, you know, some of the guys are doing Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, you know, and then Wednesday, Thursday off and then back, you know, depending on, yeah, who you are and your position and what, you know, if they need you on Tuesday and stuff. But yeah, I mean, right, generally it's 4 on, 3 off.
Yeah, yeah, it's the schedule is, you know, and I think it helps a lot of guys recover a little bit more, you know, because back then, you know, when I started, we had no trainers. You brought your own tape to tape yourself up. We had no doctor. We didn't have anything. It was just the boys helping the boys, and that was it. If you got hurt and got a concussion, I remember I got a concussion one night. You know, I was in a tag match. It was me and X-Pac, 1-2-3 Kid back then, against the Smoking Guns. And I got a concussion on Monday Night Raw that following Monday night after the pay-per-view when we won the belts from from Tatanka and we had lost the, you know, we went on Monday Night Raw to defend the titles against the Smoking Guns, and the first match on Raw, because we would tape, I think, 3 Monday Night Raws in a row, 2 or 3, I think it was 2 or 3, I can't remember. We did so much filming, it was just crazy. And we did one live Raw, which that's the night we dropped the belts to the Smoking Guns, and I got a concussion off a double team move that they had did to where they beat me for the title. And then that was the end of the show. And then, or there was another match or something. But anyway, I had to go back on 20 minutes later. Well, I walked back to the dressing room, and I recall I couldn't remember where I was supposed to go. And Pat Patterson came up to me and asked me if I was okay. And I was like, I don't know where I am. And so, you know, back then, it's like if you had a concussion, you still had to perform. And because I had to go back out 20 minutes later and do another match with the Smoking Guns for a rematch for the title, you know, which obviously we lost. But and it's funny because when we were going over our second match, Billy Gunn looked at me and goes, "What's wrong with you?" I'm like, "What are you talking about?" And he's like, "Are you just not listening to what we're saying?" You know, because we were going over the match, and that I was riding with them at the time, so they kind of figured something was wrong. Because it's funny because I had a concussion, and this is what's really bizarre about that, is I remember getting knocked out because I was laying there. I wasn't all the way out, and after Earl counted the 1-2-3, he looked at me, and he goes, "Are you okay?" Because I guess he saw it in my eyes that something wasn't right. And that was the first time. And so, you know, and of course, Pat Patterson asked me, and so I knew right there something was wrong. But somehow I went out there and did what I had to do. And, you know, and the point getting to is nowadays concussions, you're off. But back then, like I said, we didn't have trainers, did doctors or anything. You had a concussion, you had to roll on. I mean, you just had to suck it up and go. And I'll never forget, I was throwing up the next day, and it was brutal. But you know, I survived, which, you know, that was a dangerous situation for me. But, I mean, I lived through it, you know, and moved on. But, like, the point I'm making is it's funny because they have trainers, doctors, everything, the whole nine yards these days. And back in the day, you know, when I first started, there was none of that stuff. And it's just, it's bizarre how everything's evolved.
Well, let me ask you this question. So, besides the expectation that, okay, I need to go out and perform, I have often heard people say that, well, you know, back then we didn't know how dangerous concussions were. And my feeling has always been, I remember the 90s when I saw people taking unprotected chair shots to the head. And I remember back then it was like, this is not good for your head. This is not good for you long term. It's not good getting a concussion. It's not good, you know, getting walloped in the head. And I mean, for you and for others in the company, I mean, was there kind of, I mean, I would presume there would have had to have been that understanding even back then, but you knew that you had to go out there and just protect yourself the best you could. I'm not sure that's really, I mean, you'd know better than I, having been back there with the rest of the guys, but I'm skeptical of this idea that back then people did not know that concussions were bad.
No, you're right. Well, you're absolutely right.
But they don't know what they know now, though.
Right, yeah, because there wasn't research like they have now. You know, for whatever reason, they did a bunch of research now, I guess, because...
Well, sure, but I mean, even back then, you still knew about boxers and post-boxing dementia and the fact that, you know, this was a result of getting hit in the head too much. I mean, you know, we didn't know about tau proteins and that sort of thing, but I think everyone still pretty much knew this is bad.
Yep, I just wonder if, you know, in professional wrestling, they really didn't look at it, you know, look too hard at it, because maybe they thought, you know, wrestling is just, you know, it is what it is. It's entertainment. And these guys aren't really getting hit. But in all reality, we are getting hit, you know, and because I do remember that when the whole hardcore thing started, I was working with Bubba Dudley on a nightly basis, and I was taking a chair shot on the house shows every single night. And after about the fifth night, I went to Vince at TV. And I said, Vince, we're going to have to do something, because I feel like I'm punch drunk, you know, just walking around now, because I've been getting hit in the head every single night. And, you know, and so that's when I just kind of like started really protecting, you know, my head. And they, you know, that's when Vince is like, you know, hey, let's just come up with a different way to use the chair then on the house shows. And then that's what we did. Because, you know, Mick Foley, I talked to Mick Foley about it, and he said the same thing. He said that he was taking chair shots like that every night, and he got to the point he couldn't do it anymore. And, you know, and I went through that, and I understood where he was coming from. You know, it's like you walk around in a fog. And I'd get up the next, you know, every morning I'd get up, and I knew something wasn't right. But you just move on, and then that night, another crack to the head, and then next night, another crack to the head, and then by then, it's like you're almost like a zombie walking around, you know? And so, and that's when they, you know, house shows, they started, you know, utilizing a chair in a different manner instead of headshots or throwing your hand up. And it's just funny because I always hated throwing my hand up, because I didn't want people to see, oh, he threw his hand up, his hand took the, you know, and it was a pride thing with me. But it was almost like the smart thing to do regardless. And so I, you know, really started protecting myself a lot better after that.
Well, you know, you were friends with Chris Benoit, and I mean, it's now 6 years later, 6+ years later. And a lot of research has come out since then, and then he was, you know, he was actually part of that, you know, and a lot of stuff, you know, it's more come out in pro football, I mean, as far as a lot of major media publicity. But do you look back and have a different feel, or what's kind of like, I mean, I read your book, and I know what you said, and I'm sure it was really difficult to write those pages. I mean, it had to have been.
Yeah.
Do you, I mean, what's kind of like when you look back, and I mean, it's like, it's someone that you know, I can't imagine... You know, again, like that whole week or day or whatever, when that thing sort of came through, it was like, you know, you just, you know, the you know, the thing of I can imagine guys, you know, and I've, you know, you see it with the football players and things and stuff that they do, and even guys, and I think that there's some guys who may have committed suicide in wrestling, due to depression brought on by concussions and things like that, or as part of it. It may not be the whole 100% reason, but that may have been a factor. But with Chris, it was such a you know, it's a heinous crime of someone that you knew and I think you trained with and all that.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, what was kind of like your reaction and looking back with the research that's been done, I mean, do you kind of have a different conclusion now than maybe you had then?
No, I still have the same conclusion. It's, you know, because I think back of all the times that we were together and Chris just never acted out of the normal. You know, he was just always polite, always kind to everybody, never had a bad word to say to anybody. Just, you know, there was no signs of him acting any different. And that's why I hate to try to say, yeah, okay, yeah, maybe it was because of the concussions and he went ballistic or whatever, but I truly don't believe that was the case, because he would just, he didn't seem depressed. He didn't seem any of that. And I wish people could see what I'm talking about. You know, I wish they could have hung around him to see, because he was always in a good mood. You know, he was quiet, but anytime you talked to him, he'd start a conversation or whatever, riding down the road, we'd work out, and he was, he'd make jokes and stuff like that. He never, ever seemed depressed. And that's what just blows my mind, because, you know, they did the study and they try to, you know, say it was, you know, certain things that caused it. I just, you know, and I can't remember if they solely blamed part of it on having concussions. You know, did they try to blame it on the concussions completely, or were they trying to say?
I think that there's a lot of people who want, you know, I mean, certainly the concussion people and his father certainly wanted to blame 100% of the blame on concussions, and there are other people who, you know, I know a guy who, you know, researched it, and then he and I have talked about it a lot, and his thing is like, it's 100%, and I go like, I don't know, it's hard for me to rationalize 100%, and it's also the way that it was described, and I know that Chris Nowinski's kind of said it in a different way, but when they start talking about, you know, the brain of an 80-year-old, and you were around him, and I didn't know him well, but I knew enough to know he didn't have the brain of an 80-year-old, and only just because of how could he have gotten to the shows and how could he have performed in the ring the way he did if he was, you know, suffering from, you know, pugilistic, just, you know, dementia, you know, like a
well, one thing, let me just jump in right here. I don't even know what that means, having the brain of an 80-year-old, because my grandmother is 84 and she's on the show once a week and she's way sharper than I am. You know, she has no trouble finding her way anywhere. She doesn't forget anything. She's got a great memory. I mean, what does that even mean, that someone has the brain of an 80-year-old?
Well,
there are plenty of
Alzheimer's patient, not an 80-year-old normal person.
I see.
Well, the thing is, that's not the case. So, that's why I say that the whole concussion thing is BS. You know, let me tell you something, because I rode with Chris. You know, I was with him before all that shit went down. You know, excuse my language, but I was with him. I know how he acted, and I worked with him in the ring. We talked about wrestling. Whenever we're working, he wouldn't forget anything. How could somebody that had a concussion, you know, if they want to blame it on that, how could he, you know, how can he function like he did? Because he acted perfectly normal. I mean, he wasn't a hothead. He wasn't, you know, there was so many other factors that we will never know what caused this. And I don't care what anybody says. We were not in that house at the time everything went down, because we do not know what happened between him and Nancy. You know, so all these people want to speculate and say this is what happened. They're full of garbage, because nobody knows what went down, because a lot of alcohol was involved. You know, so they can't pinpoint it on concussions, because nobody knows the history of Chris and Nancy. Nobody knows the problems they were having, you know. And so I really, in my heart, in my mind, I really believe alcohol played a huge factor in what happened that night. And I don't drink. I hate alcohol. If I can go back to prohibition with alcohol, believe me, I would be the first one to do it, because alcohol causes so many issues with so many families, more than any drug does more than any problem, more than anything. Alcohol creates more problems amongst the society than any drug or anything on this planet. You know, and I mean, cops deal with drunk people on a daily basis, drunk driving, all that stuff, people getting killed or whatever. I truly believe in my heart of hearts, you know, number one, nobody knows what went on between Chris and Nancy because nobody was there. And number two, a ton of alcohol was involved. And that's, you know, and this is solely my opinion. And I truly believe that, and I stand by it, you know, and because so many people say, well, this is what happened, this is what happened. No, nobody knows what happened. All they can say is, you know, they got into a fight. Unfortunate circumstances happened. And the thing is, knowing Chris, I would have never bet in a million years that he could honestly do the heinous crime that he did. You know, and it makes me look at him in a different light. I still respect him as a worker, but I totally lost every ounce of respect for him after what he did. But I still have a ton of respect for him as a worker. But as a human being, I lost every ounce of respect for him. Because that was cowardly what he did, number one. And, you know, and Chris was a good friend of mine. But that's solely my opinion on what happened. I just don't believe all that concussion BS is what started the whole thing, or steroids or what, all that. So there you have it from me.
One thing happened recently, and I mean, you had a long history with Jim Ross. I mean, he was in the company for a long time, a head of talent relations and things like that. And at times, you were kind of one of his enforcers. I mean, do you have any kind of thoughts as far as his longevity there and the ending of his career there? Because in some ways, I don't want to, you know, they're completely different, but I almost see a similarity in your exit and his, in the sense that you're there a long time, and then all of a sudden it's just, you know, something happens that I don't know, you know, like exactly, you know, how minor it was. But I mean, I mean, I know I read in the book basically how, you know, your thing ended. And I know with Jim Ross, I actually saw, you know, the tape of what it was. And it's just kind of like, you know, you kind of go like after whatever it is, 20 years, and it's just like that's the end. I don't know. I mean, like, what, you know, what's kind of your thoughts on, because you know the good and the bad of Jim Ross.
Yeah. I think, this is my opinion. I think they were just looking for a reason to get rid of him, because I thought that was just kind of a bogus reason to let him go. I really do. And yeah, here's a man that was the best of the best of, you know, television announcers. I mean, they didn't get no better than that guy. And for them to let him go over something like that, that tells me they've been wanting to look for an avenue to get rid of him. And I don't know why. That's the thing. I don't know why, because Jim was a company man, you know? Yeah, he stood up for what he believed, and you know, he went against the grain sometimes, but everybody should do that. You should stand up for what you believe. And because, you know, everybody needs a difference in opinions on certain things. And I just, you know, I only saw a portion of the thing. And I honestly thought it didn't seem like it was that bad to me, you know, and I thought this is a little, you know, for Jim Ross to lose his job over this is just really petty. And it just told me that somebody wanted him gone for whatever reason, because here's a man that was there 20 plus years. I mean, he was there WrestleMania 1. Wasn't WrestleMania his first?
He wasn't WrestleMania 1, but it was WrestleMania 93 would have been his first show.
Okay, yeah, okay. It was in Vegas. That's right. I'm sorry.
Was that 8 or 9? Whatever. The one in Vegas was his first show. So I think that's 8.
Yeah. And then here he is just, you know, doing everything that he needs to do. I mean, he was over, you know, as a television commentator. I mean, whenever you think of television commentators, you think of Jim Ross. And for them just to let him go like that, it just tells me, you know, somebody wanted him gone, and it's like, okay, is Vince not running the show anymore? Is, you know, Who wanted him gone? I just can only imagine.
I think that, you know, based on what I think that you were right in the sense that that there was a, you know, they were looking for a reason to get rid of him because that wasn't going to be 100% the reason, and it was probably Vince for, you know, again, you know, whatever reason, you know, Vince had.
Right, and for him, a week before, prior to that happening, he had no plans on retiring, none whatsoever, and then WWE makes a statement that Jim Ross is retiring. Or however they came out and said he was retiring, whatever, is just to cover their ass because they knew they would get a lot of heat for it. And I think the people are smarter than that. They know that he was let go, you know, and he, to me, that was just so wrong. It's so wrong. And I think, you know, hopefully they're compensating him, giving us a nice severance package because he deserves a big fat severance package for the crap that he put up with all those years being humiliated and embarrassed on live TV, you know, and made fun of, which I thought was not right. You know, and the only reason Jim Ross is okay with it because he wanted his job. He loved his job. Because I promise you, you know, at the fun of making fun of somebody's handicap, that's not a good thing. That's not the right thing to do. Even if you say it's okay, you know, and I'm sure Jim Ross didn't mind it, or maybe he did what he would never say. But I just think that man deserves a big, huge, fat severance from that company for putting up with the crap that he put up with for all those years. And then I think he was fired, you know, once or twice for no reason whatsoever, you know, that was totally out of his control. And I think, you know, prior to all this, before, it was way back, I'm not sure when, but yeah, it just, you know, it bothers me how they treat people that have been loyal to them, you know, like Jim Ross. And it just, you know, Jim should retire there. He should, you know, his dying days should be with WWE because that was his life, you know? So, but it is what it is. But everybody knows the truth, you know? So that's just the way I think about it.
One thing, when you did a show earlier this year for TNA, one of those taped pay-per-view shows, I think it's a hardcore show. I don't know if you did one or more than one, but what was your thoughts as far as going there? When you went there, were you looking at the idea of maybe I'll go back there, or was it in your mind, I'm going to do this once because they asked and it's just something that I would want to do? I mean, what was kind of the thought process or the, you know, how you got to do it and, you know, what your thought was when you did it?
Yeah, as everybody knows, me and Al Snow are good friends. We've always been friends, and because I feel like I'll forever have a connection with Al because of the whole hardcore matches that we've had and him teaching me, you know, utilizing, hey, you only need two or three things to make something mean something, you know, and I'll be forever grateful for him because he's the one that actually taught me how to do all the hardcore stuff the proper way. And I've always loved Al. We've traveled together before and stuff like that. And I just laugh because of some of those stories that, you know, he speaks of when we were together. He's just, it makes me laugh at his expressions and stuff because it's priceless. But anyway, if you guys ever get him on, get him to tell you about the story of how I was always up at 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning wanting to go work out no matter how late we got in. You've got to get him to tell you that story. Because he had to go to the bathroom so bad, and he was holding it, and he was so scared I was going to wake up. But anyway, that's for another time. But anyway, so Al had called me and asked, hey, will you do me a favor? And I'm like, sure, what's that? And he said, you know, we're doing a hardcore-themed pay-per-view. Would you like to be part of it? And I'm like, sure, why not? And he said, we had a meeting, and I brought your name up, and Hogan said, yeah, call him and get him come in. And so I did it, and I thought, you know, this would just be a one-off deal, plus I'd like to see how they do things, you know, because I'm always curious to see how you know, different companies do different things as opposed to WWE. And so, you know, I went down there, and you know, it's kind of a different setup because it was the Universal Studios, you know, a little bit different than what I was used to, but that was how they did things, and it worked for them. And, you know, and I met a lot of guys, you know, people I've never met before, and everybody was very gracious. Everybody was very welcoming. you know, it was a great overall experience for me. And after I had worked that night, you know, I thought, you know, well, if they want me to come back, you know, I might. And, you know, and then I really never thought about it after that. But I did have a very enjoyable experience. I had a good time. You know, everybody seemed like they were, this was before TNA started, like, you hear on all these rumors of them having money problems and stuff like that. And everybody just seemed like so happy, so stress-free. And because, you know, I talked to Devon Dudley and Bubba Ray, and he said, shoot, it's kick back. Everybody has a good time here. We get to do whatever, you know, our own thing. We're not under any pressure or any, you know, nobody's pointing fingers at anybody. And I'm like, wow, that's different. You know, and he said, the thing is, he says, you don't have people trying to stab you in the back here. And I'm like, that's huge. You know, it's, and he said, everybody here works really well together. You know, and that was good to hear. And so, and I did give it a thought that, hey, you know, if they call me, maybe I would go back and do, you know, something else. I wouldn't want to do it on a full-time basis. You know, but if they wanted me to come in and do stuff here and there, maybe I would. But now, you know, now hearing the troubles, you know, I'm not going to mention any names, but I was with somebody 2 weeks ago in Boston who works for TNA, and they're having trouble getting their paychecks. You know, that they're like a month and a half behind, and they're, you know, and they're struggling to get paid. And it's like, wow, do I want to be part of that? No, you know. And so, because that's really aggravating. You go out there and those guys work so hard to put on a good show for the fans, because everybody down there does work hard. And because I was watching the matches, and everybody does. They put everything they have into it to try to deliver a good product. And, you know, and then these guys, they're not getting paid, or you know, if they're getting paid, they're getting paid, you know, weeks and maybe months down the road. And it's just, it's not fair to them, you know, because they deliver on a nightly basis. They should be getting their money. And so, you know, like I said, I'm not going to mention no names who told me that, but because, you know, they're still with the company. But the thing is, it's from the things I've seen and, you know, read. And like I said, when I read something, I don't put too much into it, because you don't really know unless you're there. But, you know, they're having financial issues from what I understand. And, you know, and I don't feel like, you know, I want to be part of that, you know. And it's the, like I said, and I try to watch the show, and it just seems like the product isn't like it was a year ago. And I don't know why. And, you know, maybe it's because they're just not paying the money to get talent in that they should be getting, because there's a lot of good talent from WWE sitting at home, you know, that doesn't work for WWE anymore, that could be helping TNA grow. But they won't pick them up. They won't pay them. And I just don't understand that, because you have to, if you want good talent, you got to pay for it. And from what I understand, they're going to start hiring guys that, you know, independent guys, and please forgive me, you know, the way I say it, you know, but it's almost like, you know, they're taking guys that nobody knows and trying to make them a star right away, and you have to slowly build those guys, you know. And I don't know if they're going to try to do that, or, you know, like I said, I don't know. And, you know, and to me, to make a product work, you've got to get well-known names to make something work. And because you got to have these guys teach these younger guys coming in, this is how it's done. And I don't see them doing that. I don't think they want to invest in, you know, well-known names for whatever reason. I don't understand that, you know? And so, I may be wrong. I don't know, but that's just the way I see it from somebody on the outside trying to look in.
Now, before we go, you've got some dates coming up in England and Australia in November.
Yes.
So life's good, it looks like. Tell us a little bit about that, and let's get some plugs in for the book as well.
Yeah, I'm I believe it's November 15th to the 18th. I'll be in wrestling for PCW out of England and Southside Wrestling. From what I understand, they're a very good outfit. I've heard many great things about them, and I'm really looking forward to going over there. Chris Masters is going to be there. Shannon Moore is going to be there. Awesome Kong is going to be there. There's going to be a few more names there. And then, you know, of course, I'm going to be there. But then I'm going to Australia right after that. As soon as I get home, I've got 12 hours at home. Then I leave for Australia. I'm going to be in Sydney on November 22nd for AWE, Australia Wrestling Entertainment, and then Perth for AAA, All Action Wrestling. In Melbourne, I'm doing a wrestling seminar actually in Melbourne, Australia, for Explosive Pro Wrestling. Then Adelaide, seminar there, and then a wrestling show that night. And then Adelaide on the 27th, and then back to Melbourne for a show for Melbourne City Wrestling. And then I get to come home. And then, you know, and like I said, that's good enough for me right there. And then I'll probably take, you know, a few months off, and then I think I'm going to do a show in March for a group out of Chicago. So I space my stuff apart so I don't get too burnt out. But and then, you know, of course, my book is doing really good. I've had great reviews on Amazon.com. If anybody out there is not sure about my book, go to Amazon.com and read my reviews, The Hardcore Truth, Bob Holly Story, and you know, make your decision based on the reviews if you want to get it or not. But I'm on Twitter. I'm also on Twitter at the Bob Holly. And just to let everybody know, I do talk to everybody. And honestly, that is my way to give back to my fans, to say thank you for all your support. Because I know what it's like to send somebody a tweet and they don't answer you. You know, I've seen people send, you know, other people tweets over and over trying to get just a hello or something. And I know how that feels for those people. So I try to, you know, put myself in their position. And if you send me a tweet, I promise you I will answer it. And if I don't answer it right away, I will get to it. I don't exclude anybody. I don't care how many followers I have. I will get to your tweet. I will not ignore it. And anybody, of course, unless it's a derogatory or negative comment, then I just ignore it. And I won't get into the argument. I won't go into no Twitter war with anybody. So if you want to get a Twitter war out of me, you can hang that up, because I'll just completely ignore it. So, but yeah, and I just, you know, and that's, to me, when I speak to everybody on Twitter, honestly, that's my way of giving back to everybody. And it's the least I can do. You know, and I do stop and take the time to answer everybody. So, you know, you look for me at the Bob Holly, and I really want to thank you guys for having me on your show. It's been great. I always have a great time talking to you guys, too, and I thank you very much.
Well, we're obviously going to have you back on very soon, hopefully. And as noted on Amazon.com, 4.7 out of 5 stars. And only a very small number of under 5-star ratings, and nothing below 3. So,
can I talk about the book real quick, because I think people know how busy I am, and just to let you know how much I like the book. Is I read the book, you know, before Bob was on the first time, and then I don't know what it was, about 2 months ago or so. You know, I was on a trip. It was one of the UFC trips, and it's like, I'm going to just bring it just because, you know, I like the book that much. I really like the book a lot. And I ended up sitting there, and I read the whole book from start to finish a second time. And it was actually, I actually enjoyed it considerably more the second time than the first. And I enjoyed it a lot the first. It's a really good book. I mean, as far as like the period of wrestling that he talks about in WWE, there's not really a lot of books on that period from, you know, before like the 2000 period. I mean, it's really him and Brett as far as like books. And I mean, it's the thing that, you know, that I loved about the book, which I've told Bob, is whether you agree with everything, or you agree with 70%, or you agree with 80%, you know, whatever it is that he says, you know, you're getting the, I guess, unvarnished truth, to use the word. I mean, it's like I read the book, and it's like, this is the guy's real opinion on everyone at every circumstance. It's just like, you know, like one of the one things I really liked was when you talked about Shawn, and it's like, yeah, you know, Shawn Michaels you get along with now, but when you talked about Shawn Michaels of the 90s, I mean, you didn't go, well, Shawn's my friend now, I'll just, like, you know, I'll just pretend that never happened. I mean, it's
right,
like,
right.
You know, that really won me over in the book, because it's like, okay, you know, he's, and you know, you're given, whatever it is, this is your perspective on every single one of these situations, and there's a lot, you know, a lot of stuff for a lot of years there. And it's an excellent book.
And the whole thing is, you know, Ross Williams put it all together. You know, he put my story down in my words, you know, and he did a great job. I have to give him a lot of credit because he did a terrific job. I don't think I could have found a better writer than him. But when we sat down to do this project, you know, I want it to be to where, you know, there's certain books out there where they kind of dance around certain subjects and because they're afraid they're going to hurt somebody's feelings, you know, and I didn't want to be like that. You know, take, you know, Sean and Hunter, for example. Yeah, I told people how I felt about Sean back in the early days, but I also put those guys over and give them credit for how good they are. You know, despite them being the way they were, I also do give them credit, you know, like Hunter. I don't like the man, but I respect his mind for the business, and I have a lot of respect for how good he is. But you all also read my opinion about what I think of him, too. You know, and you know, I hit both sides of the fence on everything, pretty much. And like, you know, like you said, it's just my opinion on things, and people can take it for what it's worth. If they don't want to believe it, that's fine. You know, and it's how I felt about everything, you know, and I was always, you know, if, you know, certain people that I've worked with and I talk about how I felt about them, but I wasn't worried about, oh, well, you know, they're going to come back and say, hate me and all this. I wasn't worried about that because it's how I felt at the time, in my opinion. So, you know, the book is a lot about that. And I think it comes off refreshing to people to see a book like that, you know, and I may be wrong, but I've got a, you know, I think people like to see, you know, how you feel, people feel about certain things. And so, you know, it just, I'm very fortunate. I'll tell you, I'm very fortunate. And I thank you guys again for reading my book and helping me sell it too, because like I said, I couldn't do it without you all, and thank you very much. I'm very grateful. I promise you, I am one of the most grateful, thankful people you will ever meet in your entire life. It may not come across that way on TV because of the character I portray, but I grew up being thankful for everything that everyone has ever done for me. And you guys, I am forever grateful for having me on your show and helping me sell my book. And I truly thank you.
Well, thanks so much. And, of course, thanks, everybody, for listening. Check out the book on Amazon.com, and you can contact Bob at TheBobHawley on Twitter. And we're going to be back a little bit later on, so check out the front page for more, and we'll talk to you again after a while.